It vibrates with creativity and hums with brilliant performances. That's Richard Roper of Ebert and Roper talking about American Splendor. That's right, our old movie this week here on Cinephiles. I continue my love affair with the great Paul Giamatti. Last week, we talked about Cinderella Man. This week, American Splendor. As far as new movies are concerned, Fargo Season 5, all 10 episodes I've seen, they're in the books. Fantastic show on FX. And our wild card, that's right, Charles Stone III, terrific director, and he's got a new film called The Underdogs, 3 G's for our man Snoop Dogg. It's available on Amazon Prime this Friday. He's got great stories about working with Bernie Mac on Mr. 3000, Paid in Full, Cameron, and of course this new film. And of course the commercials back then, well, yeah, Charles Stone III came up with those commercials which were very, very famous. But of course, the real new here is the Oscar nominations, which were released an hour ago, 9:35. Chris Cody and I are taping this right now, 8:30 a.m. They were announced on Good Morning America. And a guy who has some familiarity with Oscar nominations being announced is Chris Cody. 8:30 a.m. Eastern is when I was watching on Good Morning America, making notes. But you were a part of a watch party at a much earlier time in Los Angeles with a much bigger name.
A few years ago, during Super Bowl week, Adam McKay, friends with Dan, they were up for, what was the movie? Refresh My Drink a couple years ago. What was the movie?
It was the movie that wasn't great.
It was the environmental movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, so that movie was up for nominations. That movie was up for nominations. We went to Adam McKay's house and they were having
Don't Look Up was the movie.
The way you would have a Super Bowl watch party, they were having at like 5 a.m. local time, just people over, a breakfast spread, waiting to hear if they were nominated. It was cool to see from that perspective, because like for me, like get me to the Oscars, like this part, this day hasn't never really been. But ever since that day, I have a respect for how big today is. Like, is this your Christmas morning or is Oscar Christmas morning?
I was about to say Oscars would be Christmas, but this would be Christmas Eve, right? This is the precursor to the big event. And it is pretty exciting when they announce it. I got to be honest, man. Like, I'm one of those guys who's obviously geeking out about it, as is, I'm sure, David Sampson. He was live doing nothing personal, but he's going to do his recap here shortly. But yeah, because you think things are going to go a certain way, but you never know. I mean, like every year, like, oh, he's going to get nominated, and then he doesn't, or she's got to be a cinch, and then she doesn't. So you're like, let's put the cart before the horse. Let's get the nomination first. And as a guy, as I've told you, I just want to win an Emmy Award one day. I just would like to get nominated. Like, it would be an honor to be nominated for Best Studio Host Emmy Awards one day. So I get really excited about the nominations. So here's what we're gonna do: top 10 things that I'm thrilled about and top 5 things that are snubbed. So that's the kind of way that I'm gonna focus on this and attack this. I'm thrilled to see Past Lives was nominated for Best Picture. That's a great sign for that movie. Independent film, came out in the summer. Normally those are two knocks against a movie getting nominated. Independent movie, a summer movie, but I thought it was a beautiful story. Greta Lee, fantastic. She was not nominated, but the film was nominated for Best Picture. I'm thrilled to see that. Past Lives was number 6 on my top 10 movies of the year. Great to see that. Number 9. So Barbie people are talking, and they're going to be talking a lot about the fact, and we'll get to the snubs in just a second. Greta Gerwig was not nominated for Best Director. Margot Robbie was not nominated Best Actress. But I'm thrilled about fellow Canadian. Ryan Gosling comes through with Best Supporting Actor. He's a terrific actor and a great guy. And honestly, I think that's a pretty risky part. I mean, he's done a lot of challenging roles, but to play Ken, like you got an 8-pack and a bleach blonde hair, like that is... But a difficult role, I think, in many ways. And I thought he knocked it out of the park. So good for Ryan Gosling. And what is a loaded category?
I felt like everything about like the writing, the set design, I felt like there were a lot of things about Barbie that were nomination worthy. Yeah. But like the performances, really, like Ken, I don't know. That was a weird one.
That's the one you're out on. You're not as thrilled about. Yeah.
I just felt like I didn't leave there being like, man, those performances. Like I was like, original movie, cool to look at. Like I didn't walk away there being like, man, Gosling was amazing.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I'm here on that. I don't, now that I think about it, yeah, I was probably more looking at the dollhouses and the production design rather than going, but I did think it was a fearless performance. But you're right. I didn't walk out there and going, that's an Oscar nomination worthy performance of Ryan Gosling. You're 100% right on that. But I'm still thrilled, fellow Canadian, he comes through. Number 8. Thelma Schoonmaker, amazing, living legend. She's edited every single Martin Scorsese movie since Raging Bull in 1980. She's nominated for Best Editing, Killers of the Flower Moon. Yay, Thelma. Of course, previous winner, she's the best. Speaking of Killers of the Flower Moon, the late Robbie Robertson, integral member of the band, passed away this summer. A member of the Native community, not Osage, it was Mohawk from Canada. Lived in a reservation growing up. Marty's boy. They've worked together since The Last Waltz. He gets nominated Best Original Score and Killers of the Flower Moon. A surprise gets nominated for Best Original Song. One of those songs in the movie. awesome. Only thing that does hurt me is I think they took the nomination away from Peaches, our boy Jack Black, who had a decent chance of being nominated for Super Mario Brothers. But the Killers of the Flower Moon song, amazing. That gets nominated. Number six, on the top 10 things I'm thrilled about with the Oscar nominations, one of my favorite actors, the great Mark Ruffalo, gets nominated for Poor Things. Absolutely hysterical in the movie. Poor Things was number five on my best pictures of the year. And I just think Ruffalo has been a terrific actor for a long time. I was really upset when he lost for Spotlight. I really wanted him to win there. I don't think he wins in this performance, but playing a devilish cad, I thought he was absolutely hysterical. As my friend Eric Nays said, I think his girlfriend said, that's kind of what you wouldn't used to seeing Mark Ruffalo in. And I thought his performance was great. It does take away from my boy Willem Dafoe. We'll talk about that in a second. Meantime, number five, things I'm thrilled about. Sterling K. Brown, nominated for Best Supporting Actor for American Fiction. I met him a few years ago, Celebrity Softball, which I used to be the voice of. It was right after The People versus O.J. Simpson came out. He played Christopher Darden. By the way, guy in great shape, hit the ball a mile, and he was awesome. It was very nice to meet my wife. I was like, hey, man, I think you're going to be a great actor, and all the props to you. You were awesome in this show. He's like, thank you. Could not have been more gracious. Just to see him get his first Academy Award nomination. You know, it's funny, when you watch these movies, it's tough to predict. Like Chris said, you don't walk at a Barbie and saying that's going to get nominated. When I saw American Fiction, I watched it on my laptop. I got sent the screener because of John Ortiz interview. I go, that's an Oscar-worthy performance. And he wasn't getting nominated for anything. He didn't get nominated from the Golden Globes. And I go, dude, I closed the laptop. I didn't walk out of the movie. When I closed my laptop, I said, Jeffrey Wright and Sterling K. Brown should both get nominated. So I was so happy Sterling K. Brown did get recognized by the SAGs, Screen Actors Guild Awards, and by the Academy today, Best Supporting Actor. Speaking of American Fiction, great showing for what was my number four best picture of the movie. I'm thrilled for American Fiction, especially its lead actor, the incredible Jeffrey Wright. He gets his first Best Actor nomination. Happy to see him recognized. Colman Domingo also for People of Color. Two black actors nominated for Best Actor. That's good to see. I wasn't as bullish on Rustin as a movie, but if you remember, I did love Colman Domingo's performance. Number three, Bob De Niro's back. 80 years old, his first Oscar nomination in a dozen years, playing an absolutely villainous character. Call me King. Call me Uncle like he used to. He's unbelievable. I've now seen Killers of the Flower Moon four times. Okay. I saw it twice in theaters, as you all know. I saw it once New Year's Eve when Cody was getting after it. I had a screener in my laptop. It said this will expire at midnight. So I go, okay, I got to get in one more showing. And then last week, I forced my wife to watch because she will not watch on the DVD player. She only likes to watch streaming, upstairs TV. I go, fine, streaming, we're putting it on right now. Kids are at school 3.5 hours. Let's go. I missed 10 minutes when I had to go get one of the kids from school, but of course I've seen the movie three times. Point is, Killers of the Flower Moon four times. And I said to her, Cody, I said, what'd you think? She goes, really good. She goes, I thought the first half is better than the second half. It's a little long. She goes, but I thought De Niro was incredible. I go, exactly. She goes, I thought he was unbelievable. Like, he's a great villain.
I give you as much shit as anyone about your obsession with this group of guys, but that is a warranted, at this age even, a warranted nice. Nomination for De Niro. He was great.
I love it. I love the backup. His first nomination, by the way, since Silver Linings Playbook, which is a movie you and I both like a lot as well. Number two, what I'm thrilled about. And this kind of gets back to our conversation. You go, hey, gotta get the nomination first. And let the record reflect, Cillian Murphy is still the favorite to win Best Actor. But Ben Lyons was the first guy who whispered in my ear, your guy's going to win. And I go, no, let's get a nomination first. And so number two thing that I'm thrilled about, Paul Giamatti just got his first nomination for Best Actor ever. He is nominated for The Holdovers. That's a great sign for him and for the movie, which is up for Best Picture. But perhaps now we see a pathway. Giamatti's nominated. He's got a 20% chance. Five nominees. Maybe he can make a little push. Gold Derby, which I used to work for, they do the Oscar odds. As of 2 weeks ago, number one favorite is Cillian Murphy for actor. Number two is Bradley Cooper. Number three is Giamatti. After Giamatti won the Critics' Choice Award, he's now jumped up past Bradley Cooper. So he's now number two. So we now officially have a two-horse race. Let's see. And the number one thing I'm thrilled about, again, Martin Scorsese nominated for Best Director. I mean, the man's 80 years of age, up for Best Director. According to everyone, he's not going to win. Nolan is going to win for Oppenheimer. You could bet your mortgage on this. Christopher Nolan's going to win Best Director. But running number two right now, is Marty. If for some reason Nolan didn't win, Scorsese would win his second Best Director Oscar. Everyone knows about, as Chris said, my love affair for these guys, but this was a great nugget from my agent who just texted me. With his nomination for Killers of the Flower Moon, Martin Scorsese has surpassed Steven Spielberg to become the most nominated living film director at the Oscars. Like, that's amazing. My guy gets nominated again, and it's just awesome to see Marty get nominated again. Again, for a guy this age, to be cranking out these kind of films over the last 10 years, Wolf of Wall Street, which is one of the most popular films. He was nominated Best Director, Best Picture as well. Silence, which I loved, which was snubbed. The Irishman, Best Director, Best Picture. And now Killers of the Flower Moon, Best Picture, Best Director. It gives all of us hope. Now the stuff people really care about, the snubs. What are you mad about? Number six, Willem Dafoe, one of my favorite actors, former guest here on Cinephile. He's never won an Academy Award. He's 65 years of age. He was nominated for Platoon. He was nominated for The Florida Project, among others. Would have loved to see him nominated in Poor Things. Chris hasn't seen the movie, but even when he saw his picture, you were blown away at how ugly and disfigured he looked. For that makeup job, Willem Dafoe, classic. I would have liked to have seen a nomination. Yeah. Number five, this one will offend Samson more than me. Again, my favorite actors of all time, as you never tire of hearing, Pacino, De Niro, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Giamatti, Ethan Hawke, Denzel, but Michael J. Fox. And Michael J. Fox, I thought for sure was winning an Oscar for documentary. The movie is called Still, and he's been everywhere promoting it in New York City. I meant to go to a screening, but I was busy with other things. But the director, Davis Guggenheim, is a previous Oscar winner for An Inconvenient Truth, the Al Gore movie. Not even nominated for Best Documentary. That is shocking when I saw the nominees. I'm going to have to watch some documentaries here. 20 Days in Mariupol, which is about Ukraine, the invasion. I believe that might be the favorite to win. I haven't checked the odds yet. But as the nominations came out, I go, oh my God, Michael J. Fox not nominated. I thought he might be the favorite to win. Number four. Now we get to Barbie. So I don't really care that Greta Gerwig didn't get nominated for Best Director. Samson's losing his mind. Everyone's offended right now. I wasn't as crazy about Barbie as other people. I think Chris and I align on this. But I am shocked. One of the biggest appeals of Barbie was what? Margot Robbie. The fact that Margot Robbie did not get nominated for Best Actress, to me, that's a pretty big slight. I mean, if you're going to nominate it for Best Picture, and you're going to nominate Gosling, and you're going to nominate America Ferrera for Supporting Actress, again, to your point, I didn't walk out going, she should get an Oscar nomination. She had a great monologue, that speech about women being aggrieved and, you know, unappreciated. That's a great speech. But Margot Robbie, not she was also a producer in the film. Like, I'm a little surprised Margot Robbie did not get nominated. Number three, biggest snub. This one offends me. Alexander Payne, the guy directs The Holdovers. So you direct Giamatti towards the Best Actor nomination. You direct Divine Joy Randolph towards the Best Supporting Actress nomination. You direct the film towards the Best Picture, but you don't get nominated for director. So apparently the film directed itself. Ridiculous. Alexander Payne should have been nominated for director. I appreciate, as a guy who likes his foreign films, what they did. They actually really included more foreign films, and that's why Payne got hurt. The director nominees. So Nolan's going to win for Oppenheimer. Marty's second, Killers of the Flower Moon. Yorgo Lanthimos, the great Greek director's Poor Things. The other two are pretty surprising. Justin Trier for Anatomy of a Fall, which was number 10 on my top 10. I think it's a great film. And Jonathan Glazer, that's the Holocaust movie, The Zone of Interest. So that's two foreign films nominated for Best Director. That took away the nominees from Greta Gerwig for Barbie and Payne for The Holdovers. I don't agree with that decision. Payne should have been in it. Number two. No Leo. We knew he was in trouble once he was not nominated for the SAGs. That's the Screen Actors Guild Award. The biggest branch of the Academy is the actors. Again, this is why Ben is saying Giamatti's going to win. He said Paul Giamatti's worked for 30 years in movies. Everyone loves him. Cillian Murphy is a weird guy who only does Christopher Nolan movies. So if this is just a popularity contest, when you see your ballot, you go, Oppenheimer, yeah, that's going to get picture, director. Oh, yeah, no, I love Paul Giamatti. That guy's awesome. Big fat liar. He's in. So that's why his thought process. So then you say to yourself, well, then how did Leo not get nominated? I'm not saying he's not popular with fellow actors, but I'll say this. He doesn't play the game. Leo's not on Kimmel. He's not out promoting the movie. What he has done, which has been very shrewd, he's been really pushing Lily Gladstone. Every interview he's done is with Lily Gladstone, and he cannot keep saying enough, she should win an Oscar. Like he's not saying that, but it's his way of saying, Lily's incredible. She carried this scene. I learned so much about the Osage community. I learned about Native American rights. I learned from Lily. So he's basically saying, hey, I won the Oscar for The Revenant. I want to see you recognize her. So get her an Oscar, get Bob an Oscar, get Marty one, like whatever. But like I'm going there. So as Ben Lyons texted me this morning, he goes, Leo snubbed, probably doesn't care. I'm like, yeah, I don't think he wants to walk the red carpet. I don't think he cares about these things. He's like, whatever. Great. I didn't get nominated. But the number one biggest snub, and this was offensive. Like I literally put my hand in my head because as the nominations come out, it's in alphabetical order. They don't ever say the name, right? They just say Poor Things. And you go, okay. And then I looked and I go, that can't be right. And I knew it was right. And I was so upset. Best adapted screenplay. No nomination for Marty and Eric Roth. And I said, this is his best pathway to an Oscar because Nolan's going to win director. And Killers of the Flower Moon really has a good chance right now at Lily for actress. Maybe Robbie Robertson, I hope, for score. But I said, Marty will get screenplay. They'll say, you know what? He's a director who's crafted a lot of great stories. Eric Roth, who's won an Oscar. He worked on Munich. He worked on Forrest Gump. He, again, as I said in the pod, he said, no, Marty's got to get nominated for screenplay. Like, he is critical to this film. And I said, that's what they'll do. They like to split the vote. Nolan gets director, Marty gets screenplay, but he doesn't even get nominated for best adapted screenplay. Absolute killer. And who is to blame? As we discussed just last week with Ben Lyons, when he said to me, it's Barbie. It's Barbie's fault. If Barbie was nominated for best original screenplay, which I believe to be the case, we'd be fine. But your original screenplay nominees are Anatomy of a Fall, The Holdovers. We had Dave Hemmingsing on the pod. By the way, he might win, by the way. Okay, so we have another Oscar winner here in Cinephile. I think he's got a good chance of winning. Maestro, May, December, and Past Lives. Very happy for Past Lives, by the way, getting nominated for screenplay. Now, adapted screenplay, what do you take out? American Fiction, which I love. Thrilled to see Cord Jefferson nominated for an Oscar. Oppenheimer, great script by Nolan. Poor Things, pretty good script. Zone of Interest, again, that's the one I'm not as enamored of. I would not have Zone of Interest nominated for adapted screenplay. I would have had Marty and Eric Roth for Killers of the Flower Moon. And then you get Barbie. So Chris Connelly does a great job on Good Morning America. They asked him immediately for his reaction. The first thing he said, he goes, I'm pretty surprised Martin Scorsese did not get nominated for adapted screenplay, Eric Roth, because that one felt like a cinch and they got pushed out because apparently Barbie may have hurt them. So I'm mad at a plastic doll today. I give it to Chris Cody. What do you think? Ben says it should be adapted screenplay. It's based on material previously existing. I say, no. Adapted screenplay to me is an article, a play, a TV movie, a short story. What do you think? Is Barbie an original screenplay or adapted?
I see both sides of this, but I kind of, if you make me choose, I think I'm on Ben's side. Like, I think, like, it's adapted. These are characters. Like, I know that they put, like, they gave these characters more life, but all these things existed.
It was existing material, as I say. So that's once a killer. Listen, I'm going to finish this podcast. I got my head held up high because Marty's director, Giamatti nominated, De Niro, Jeffrey Wright, Sterling K. Brown, Mark Ruffalo. I have a lot of things to be happy about.
You got me invested in Giamatti now. Like, I have not, I can't remember the last time I've like been like, just usually I don't really have a dog in this fight. Like, I'm with you. I love Giamatti. Yeah. He needs to get this Oscar. What can we do? Is the voting already happened? How does this work? Like, has the voting already happened for winner?
Now the nomination, now the voting begins. So the next 6 weeks is a sprint. Yeah. And I don't think we can announce just yet. But let's just put it this way. The last couple of years with Cinephile, I've been in my basement tweeting away, and then Chris and I do an immediate Oscars reaction. Ben Lyons joined a couple of years ago. But this year,
bigger things planned.
Bigger work, bigger things here. And we'll just leave it at that. All right. The good news also, by the way, for all the chiding I give Cody, you're actually pretty up on the Oscars. You've seen Barbie. You've seen Oppenheimer. You've seen Killers of the Flower Moon. I mean, if you watch the holdovers, that's on Peacock. You'll knock out Giamatti. You're going to love
it. I got to see that. I'm going to watch that this weekend.
I'll tell you right now, you're going to love it. I've had friends now text me because it's on Peacock. That movie's hilarious.
He's like, I also need to see American Splendor. Just like researching it a little bit for you made me interested in that. I got to go. I don't feel like I think I've just scratched the surface of my Giamatti. I don't think I've seen nearly enough Giamatti.
That's what I would love. God, that would be the greatest compliment you could ever pay me. Like, people ask you years from now, like, your dad's like, what was it like working with Adnan? And go, honestly, he really made me love Paul Giamatti more. I'm like, yeah, I'm like, yeah, like I like Martin Scorsese. He likes him. Okay, De Niro, but you're like, I know those guys are good, but I already like Giamatti, and Adnan like pushed me to like, no, dude, he's awesome. Yeah. He's one of our great American actors. I'm like, all right, I'm in. He is one of our greatest actors. Love. The guy's the best. Let's do some other stuff.
And
right
he looks
now.
Like us.
But this is the best part of it. When I saw him, I go, he's my height. He's not skinny. He's not, you know, he's balding. Like, this is what I'm talking about. This is what a movie star should be. It doesn't have to be Paul Newman. It doesn't have to be, you know, Ryan Gosling. Paul Giamatti could be a freaking movie star, man. It's the best. I love him. Let's do Fargo real quick and then a little bit of American Splendor. Then we're going to get to our special guest. Fargo's great, man. The movie is one of my all-time favorite movies. Favorite of Ryan Russillo's as well. The only time Russillo's ever been on Cinephile. I had him on because I want to talk about Fargo and he loves it as much as I do. The show itself is interesting. So you're adapting a movie. And at first I wasn't very skeptical. The first season was awesome though. Billy Bob Thornton, one of my favorite actors. He's in my top 10. He was fantastic playing the Stone Cold Killer. Then they kind of went up and down. I appreciate Chris Rock trying a dramatic role, but I didn't think that season of Fargo was particularly strong. Not Chris's fault. I just didn't think the stories were strong. But this was a pretty strong season. And this season 5 features, among others, John Hamm, which I appreciate people listening to the pod because somebody looked at my Instagram and goes, where's your John Hamm picture? Because I mentioned previously on the pod, I think with Ben and you last week. You know, of all the people, he was the least enamored of me. John Hamm was a nice guy. He was polite, but he wasn't thrilled to talk to me. Will Ferrell was friendly. Giamatti was friendly. Bill Hader was friendly. John Hamm was just like nodding politely. I'm like, okay, yeah, Cardinals, Blues. Got it. Can I get a picture? Sure. Scott Rogowski. Got it. But having said that, I still think he's a great actor. Still very handsome. My wife's happy we got a picture with him. And he's really awesome on the show. He plays a dude who's not to be trifled with. I don't want to just say he's a Trumper, but he's definitely an isolationist. And he's a no holds barred kind of sheriff. But it's quirky because it's Fargo. Fargo takes crime stories, but then does them a little bit in a strange fashion. And I'll tell you exactly how. One of the first scenes of John Hamm, and it's in the snow. Obviously, it's Fargo. It's cold. He's in a hot tub, and the camera reveals he has nipple rings. And he has to keep an entire monologue talking. I don't know if he did it for the role. Perhaps they're just, you know, I was going to say clip-on nip-ons is what John Hamm had to do for the role. But he's literally having this conversation. He's got the big cowboy hat on. Well, that's what I'm going to tell you when it comes to law around here. And the guy's got nipple rings. I'm like, you know what? John Hamm's a pretty good actor. The fact he delivered this monologue for 5 years. Among those issues, the fact he's a stone-cold man of the law. Now, Juno Temple, who's in the movie, one of the few people I didn't talk to the Critics' Choice Awards, but Ben Lyons did. She was walking by. Ben knows Juno. He starts talking to her for a second, blah, blah, blah. She's awesome in the show. And she plays one of these women who is not to be underestimated. I mean, she's like, you know, 205 pounds, an absolute spitfire. She's really wonderful in the show as well. But what they do with Fargo is, you know, they use elements of the movie and then adapt it into the show. So one of the villains in the show, I don't have his name off the top of my head, but he's clearly playing like Anton Chigurh. Like he's channeling Javier Bardem from No Country for Old Men. And he's just strange and weird. And there's, I don't even know how to describe it. There's this insane flashback they did in the show to like 1500 years ago. He's like a Viking. And I'm like, oh my God, like Fargo, as far as television shows go, they take chances and they take shots. And I found the season 5 to be particularly rewarding. I don't know if there's gonna be any more seasons of it. Now, say this. You know, people always talk about TV being so good. Emmy Awards are done now. Movies made a comeback, man. This was a strong year. Nolan, Scorsese, Giamatti, Barbie. Like, these are big-time movies. Big shows. Succession's done now. Ted Lasso, done. Like, what's the big TV show people are watching now?
The so Bear, I'm like, but I'm with Bear, you. I'm kind of with you, though. It's
like, everyone's like, oh, TV's never been better. Movies suck. Now I'm like, no, movies are back. Like, all the best movies came out, and the TV's, like, you're right, The Bear. Okay, sure, I haven't seen it. Jeremy Allen White. You know, he's having a smoke, seemed like a nice guy. Okay. Beef. And no one's walking up the street. Hey, have you seen Beef yet? I'm like, no, like the big one, I'm telling you, Succession and Lasso being done. Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, I like. That show's done. And Fargo season 5, this could be it as well. So as far as this golden era of TV, I'm curious what HBO cooks up next.
Everyone's rewatching The Sopranos right now.
That's also
like,
true.
A lot of people I talk to are like, yeah, I'm just on season 3 of The Sopranos. I'm like, good show. Good show.
Thank you for mentioning. 25th anniversary came out. It was earlier this month, actually. Laura Brant, our booker, was like, do you want to have Alan Sepinwall on? Who's a great guy. He wrote a book called The Sopranos Sessions. Like, honestly, I've talked so much about The Sopranos. Prior to me and Chris working together, it was me and Joe at Cadence. I literally did all 86 episodes. Like, I would do like an episode recap on The Sopranos. So it's my favorite show, and I support all those rewatching it. But I feel like I've done so much here on Cinephile for the longtime listeners, like Brett Baker and David Pete. They're like, oh God, here goes that in the game with Sopranos. So I fully support a rewatch. And if you want to go back and listen to my show from 100 episodes ago, I talked about The Sopranos so many other times. All right, here's some blurbs here. Meantime from Fargo. Alan Sepinwall, speaking of a Rolling Stone. It is, in other words, a new collection of performers playing Noah Hawley's greatest hits as Fargo, the TV show, leans into what it's always done best. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with giving the people what they want. Ben Travers of IndieWire, Fargo season 5 is more concentrated than years past, but its individualized attentions not only make for a lean and mean dark comic thriller, they also befit a story about the dangers of walling yourself off from the world. Allison Herman of Variety, Fargo is a testament to the value of creativity within constraints, reworking a 27-year-old movie into a living text. It's an experiment that works better when it doesn't explicitly argue for its own continued relevance. And lastly, Sam Adams of Slate, Holly is an avid Cone's disciple, but he's a literalist. Repeating the Fargo movies, this is a true story opening at the beginning of every season 5 episode, as if it were a statement of purpose rather than a gag. We'll get to our special guest in just a second, Charles Stone III. But speaking of directors, I do have to mention RIP to the great Norman Jewison, Canadian legend. I probably shouldn't share this, but I will anyways. Dave Rutherford, my old boss, he's one of the greats of all time. Without him, I wouldn't have the career I've had. Dave was the news director at the Score Television Network. What he's known for is when somebody dies, he always texts me, what a break for whatever. So I'll give you the context of this. It first began apparently when Clemente passed away, one of my all-time favorites. Shout out to John Ortiz, his son's name is Clemente. He texted, well, he didn't text at that time. He would tell people, he said, what a break for Richie Zisk, because Richie Zisk was the Pirates' fourth outfielder. So whenever somebody dies, to this day, Dave Rutherford texts me. You know, he's a great guy. So the game is you have to then guess what it is. So he like, when Alex Trebek dies, he texted, what a break for Pat Sajak. So I have to guess, okay, who died? I'm like, oh, he's making an Alex Trebek. So the other day he texts me, he goes, what a break for Martin Scorsese. And I was like, okay, which director just died? And so then sometimes I just get bored. I'm busy. I'm like, Dave, who died? He's like, Norman Jewison. I go, oh my God, Norman Jewison, an all-time legend, Canadian legend. Norman Jewison directed In the Heat of the Night, Hometown of Toronto. He's easily the greatest Canadian director of all time. In the Heat of the Night, Sidney Poitier, incredible film. If you haven't seen it, you should see it. Rod Steiger. The Hurricane, Denzel Washington, Norman Jewison directed it. And famously, he was going to direct Malcolm X until Spike Lee played the race card and goes, hey, you can't have a brother not directing Malcolm X. And Norman Jewison, I remember, was very offended at the time. He was like, listen, I'm a white Canadian liberal. I will do this film justice. And Spike's like, nope, got to have a brother doing it. Bam. Spike directed Malcolm X, which is a power move by Spike. Anyways, Jewison, a wonderful director. I mean, I think he was 93, so had a great run. I mentioned those films, which I appreciate, but even my buddy Alpha Hill, he saw Moonstruck as a kid. I mean, I mean, that's a film you could watch again. Nicolas Cage, Cher won an Academy Award for it. So RIP to Norman Jewison, a wonderful Canadian icon and a great director. Respect due to him. Let's do a little American Splendor, shall we? This is the movie to me, like, you know, last week Chris mentioned Pig Vomit, and it is true. Private Parts put him on the map. But he does Pig Vomit. He has one scene in My Best Friend's Wedding with Julia Roberts. He's got that great scene in Donnie Brasco with Johnny Depp. I'm speaking of Giamatti, obviously. He's in Big Fat Liar. I think that's 2002. So, like, he was in movies. But American Splendor, I remember, that was the moment I go, this guy's legit. Like, this guy is a great actor. And he has said now in all these interviews and podcasts that I've listened to, that was a very important movie because he said, I was pushing hard for the role. And when I was a kid, I wanted to be a cartoonist. I wanted to be an animator. He goes, like, I thought they'd be a great job. And he goes, I knew who Harvey Pekar was. So I really pushed hard for the role and I was able to get it. I think the film had like a $2 million budget, maybe made $8 million. Sundance Film Festival is currently going on now in Utah. I've been there once. Me and Ben went years ago. It's a really cool time, especially if you like the snow. You check out a bunch of indie movies, documentaries, then go skiing. But I remember when American Splendor came out, they're like, dude, this movie's awesome. It's very original. It's very unique. Here's the story. An original mix of fiction and reality illuminates the life of comic book hero everyman, Harvey Pekar. It's directed by Sherry Springer Bergman and Robert Pulcini, co-written by Sherry Springer Bergman as well with Harvey Pekar. So they had actually made their names as documentarians. And what's so cool about the movie is the first scene, these kids are going trick-or-treating. And they go, what are you dressed as? What are you dressed as? And they look at this kid and he goes, well, I'm myself. He's like, what? I'm Harvey Pekar. She goes, well, you can't do that. He's like, well, screw this. That's the first scene of the movie. He starts walking down the street, there's great jazz music playing. And then you see the real life Harvey Pekar. And he goes, and they cut to a shot of Giamatti walking down the street. He goes, and it's Harvey Pekar's voiceover saying, so here's this guy playing me in this movie. I don't know if he looks like me, but he's me. I'm just a schlub in the streets of Cleveland. And then it cuts to a shot of Pekar in a recording studio, as I am right now with a microphone, a white background. He goes, is that good? Okay. You guys want me to do another take? They go, oh, no, it should be fine, Harvey. He's like, okay. He drinks something. He's like, all right. I hope this is going to be a good movie. We'll find out. And then it cuts to Giamatti playing Pekar. So you have this really, now they call it meta, M-E-T-A, right? This meta fiction. Like it's Harvey Pekar commenting on his life story and Giamatti playing him. In fact, in one scene, Giamatti does the scene. So you're watching the film and then it cuts to a shot again of Harvey Pekar watching Paul Giamatti doing the scene. Giamatti walks by as if he's talking to the director, talking to the cast. So I remember at the time thinking this is a pretty original film and a very unique way to tell the story. And Giamatti's lights out. I mean, it's an incredible performance because Harvey Pekar is not a warm and cuddly man. I mean, he is the epitome of curmudgeon and misanthropic. You know, just hates people, miserable. He's a file clerk, but he does these cartoons. He can't draw particularly well, but he's got a unique sense of style. And he shows it to his buddy, R. Crumb. Crumb, my favorite documentary of all time. And he says, you know what? Can I take this home and illustrate these for you? And he's like, oh my God, man, that'd be amazing. Oh my God. I can't do the Giamatti / Pekar voice, but it's kind of like, ah, it's kind of like raspy. Like, oh my God, man, that'd be awesome. So he starts drawing his cartoons, and it's cartoons for the working class. It's about a guy in Cleveland who's pissed and miserable, and he becomes a star. So it's going on Letterman. You know, Letterman at that time, counterculture, 12:30 a.m. Here's Harvey Pekar, and he becomes, I wouldn't say a star. As he says at one point, he goes, yeah, my cartoons are selling, but I'm still working as a file clerk in Cleveland. I'm not rich here, Letterman. You don't pay me much money, blah, blah, blah. But the relationship with Dave is really good. One of the few weaknesses of the movie is he had a falling out with Letterman very famously, and Late Night with David Letterman back in 03 would not release to the filmmakers the footage of when Harvey Pekar got pissed at Dave and they got into a fight. So in the movie, they see Giamatti backstage talking, I'm going to go on, and then they show Pekar when he was in Letterman, and then they'll show Giamatti. But because they couldn't get the footage of when he got pissed at him, you end up having this, and it looks like, it's one of those movies where I'm like, they didn't have much of a budget. There's nothing else they could do. They shoot it with a guy playing Letterman, but it's backlit. So you clearly tell it's not Dave. And it's Giamatti doing what Pekar did. And getting, ah, you're a real tough guy, Dave. Yeah, I'm getting mad. But I'm like, it was one of those that I'm like, I maybe wouldn't even include it. I would have just had like headlines saying Pekar fallout with Letterman. Because when you try to recreate something and you're not able to do 1,000%, to me, it wasn't as strong. That's one of the few quibbles I have of the movie. The rest of the cast is fantastic. You know, the whole Hope Davis is really good playing the love interest. Even the supporting cast, who's the guy? Jonah Friedlander. He's one of those comedians that definitely Cody would know. He's in the movie playing. His character is just so bizarre. And at one point, you see the guy he's playing. He shows up. He's got like the, you know, the nerd glasses, the crazy voice, you know, gut sticking out. I'm like, it's a really interesting mix of fiction and reality. And ultimately, the story, it's a charming love story, but a guy who nobody loves, right? He's one of these losers that you see every single day. And yet somehow, some way, he's able to survive and be successful. And like, it's almost like a tribute to life. Like, I find it life affirming. This guy is not a friendly guy. He's not a cuddly guy. And yet he's successful in his own right. And one day he just scraps through life. It's a scrappy performance. It's a scrappy movie. And it really announced Paul Giamatti as a legit lead actor. Nick Shager of Slant Magazine, an act of unabashed postmodern, that's a good word for it, postmodern self-commentary, a ploy to deliberately blur the distinction between the authentic Harvey Pekar and actor Paul Giamatti's faithful recreation. James Bertinelli, I wish once more the comic book inspired movies were like this. He's right. The next time someone says, "Oh, you don't like comic book movies?" I'm like, "No, I know. I just don't like Marvel movies. I like American Splendor. That's a comic book movie that I loved." And Jonathan Rosenbaum with Chicago Reader, "We're constantly kept on our toes regarding issues of representation, while Pekar's sour but indefatigable working class skepticism carries us along." Good review and good use of indefatigable. Go watch American Splendor. I have the DVD. I'm sure it's streaming somewhere, but go watch it. If not, go buy a DVD player like me and go watch it. Fargo Season 5 is available on FX. I'll give that 3.5 Maple Leafs as well. And of course, 4 Maple Leafs for American Splendor. Let's get to our special guest.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
The Underdogs is the new film available this Friday on Amazon Prime. I encourage all of you to check it out. Snoop Dogg coaching a bunch of football players. It's a lot of fun. It's really funny. It earns its R, which is my way of saying I enjoyed it. It's profanely funny. And its director, Charles Stone III, joins us right now, who's a terrific director. He's done a lot of great things. Great to see you, man. Congratulations on making a terrific movie.
Thank you. Thank you, man. I appreciate that. It was an amazing experience to do, too.
I want to start backwards, because having seen the film, and I don't want to blow it for anybody, but the end crawl explains what Snoop Dogg has done for youth football, which is extraordinary. I had no idea how passionate he was about this, Charles, and how it's impacted so many different levels of football, college players and some even in the NFL as well. So this was a real passion project for Snoop, right?
Yeah, no. And like you, I didn't know the depth of the passion or the resume, and that like over 20 players have gone on to the NFL. A couple were played for the Packers, you know, unfortunately they lost, as well as Texas. So it's just incredible. And like you said, you know, I think it's about 20 plus years also of doing the SYFL. It just added to it. It also just connects, it shows in, I think, Snoop's performance of understanding the character, but also his love for that culture, and that to come across being very realistic.
Yeah, I'm sure a rapper, he's top of the chain. As a businessman, of course, he's well acclaimed. But I'm curious about his style as an actor. Because I think the first thought would be, oh, Snoop's not much of an actor. And credit to his performance, so much of it feels lived in and ad-libbed and casual. But how was he take after take? As somebody, you're in the director's chair trying to mold a performance out of him. How was he?
Well, Snoop was great. He understood the character. He understood, and he also, like a lot of actors do, which is he drew from real life experiences of his own to help mold his character and just the understanding of what that character is going through, what 2J's is going through. He personally, I think technique wise, he was really present for the role. He was open to be directed and to go to sometimes uncomfortable places or out of his comfort zone in order to find certain emotions. And it's just you couldn't ask for anything better than that, is to have an actor who just is really present for the process and is open, you know, to be directed and to explore. And he did all of that. And the icing on the cake was that he was so good with the kids. He's a big kid himself, and frankly, that's his character, as well as Mike Epps' character, Kareem. They're both like man childs, you know what I mean? They're both big kids. But Snoop was so good with the kids and created a one heck of a bond that I think also just makes it very comfortable for the child actors to do their thing and really show their colors.
So one of the funniest scenes of the underdogs is about 20 minutes in, just as you're describing, when he first meets the kids and they start to recognize him. He's like, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. 2 J's, Jennings. And they go, yeah, you're the guy that used a fake penis to cheat on his drug test. And the next kid goes, yeah, you're the one who slept with an undercover cop before the playoff game. He's like, hey, come on, man. Like that to me, that kind of set the tone, right? Because you've got this Bad News Bears vibe going, but these kids are gonna get as good as they get it. Talk to me about that scene specifically, which felt really funny.
One of the things that was important for both Snoop and I was that the kids feel real, to be as real as possible and be grounded in the culture in some form or fashion. And what we did is once I narrowed down the actors that I really liked, he then would sit down with them and do a sort of a callback. They would do a scene together. And for him, it was important that one, that the kids not appear to be starstruck or to be nervous, acting opposite Snoop, and just be able to bandy about. And all the kids that are in the movie, they are all very comfortable and had no fear of Snoop or didn't feel intimidated or starstruck. And especially Jonathan Booth, who plays Trey, who's fantastic. All the kids are. Jonathan just sort of like a diamond in the rough. And you can really feel that, and he could just roll with the punches with Snoop, and it was great. So it became quite clear that there was going to be a comfort level. So when we get to those moments, like the one you're talking about, where they're like cussing back and forth at each other, it just flowed. It flowed really well, and there was a little bit of, we allowed them to improvise a little bit as well. So we got the best of both worlds in that situation.
Whole cast is terrific. Talk to me about a couple of guys I'm a big fan of. Cal Penn, who I've had on the podcast before, when he wrote a book. He's hilarious. His first scene already grabs me. You know, he's on the treadmill. He's got the pods in. You know, he's playing Snoop's agent. Already funny. And Snoop's got a great Harold and Kumar joke, which feels like an ad lib. I'm not sure if it is. And also, George Lopez. So as soon as I see him, I mean, he was great in The Blue Beetle. He's always a welcome comedic presence. Talk to me about Cal and George and what they brought to the table.
Well, I mean, Cal just so fit the role well. Like, he really handled sort of that kind of agent. And we wanted like an agent of color as well. That was important to Snoop and myself as well. And, you know, the Harold and Kumar moment, I'm thinking it's either the writers did that or it might have been Snoop. I think the writers had it in there, but we had a couple different options. And again, the way it rolls off of Snoop's tongue, it's so funny. You know what I mean? And there's been enough distance with Cal and that character that it was really funny. You know, wink, wink. In terms of George, you know, when I first read the script, George came to mind for Coach Feist, as much as he's one of my favorite comedians to stand up, and he's got this combination of charm, wit, and edge. And I knew that the Coach Feist had to have a similar feel of, first of all, he's the Yoda of the movie, right? He's the one who uses sort of Jedi mind tricks to get, you know, 2 J's to see what's really going on here and see his own selfishness. We were doing a test screenings, I think the audience was a little caught off guard because they expected, you know, George to just be like raucous from the jump. And it was never to be that. And it's only towards the end of the movie where he's cheering on the kids in the big game that George gets to let that dimension of himself really let loose in terms of being really funny. But I'm happy for him because he did such a great job of playing a more grounded sort of character that is funny, but in a way that is not just in terms of his great stand-up.
The best compliment I can pay you, Charles, the director, is I just love the pacing. That from the first shot, boom, you're into it, right? Here's the backstory, whatever prologue you want to call it. Now we go present day, boom, boom, boom. 90 minutes, efficient, entertaining. I said, this is going to appeal to all audiences. I'm not against long movies. If it's a great film, Killers of the Flower Moon, no problem. 320, 330, I got you. But I appreciate a good, lean, mean movie. How important was the pacing for a movie like this?
Well, there's a Pacing's always good. I mean, very important. I mean, even in the sense of with movies that are sort of have a slower burn, so to speak. But as long as you are going along for the ride, that you're hooked in, if the characters are strong, then it could be slow or fast. Is people timelessness, time will fall away if you're invested in the characters, right? That's just to me the golden rule. For us, this movie, I don't know, the pacing needed to move, just because it's kind of a high octane, you know, energy level journey that this character takes, because he's so brash and so full of himself. And we also wanted to get to him encountering the kids as soon as possible, because we knew that's when the fireworks were going to happen. And his attitude, the beginning, it's about his attitude. His attitude is a highlights reel. And highlights move like this. It's not watching the whole game, right? It's all the good parts. So we go through that, and he's boasting, and he's on his soapbox. So it all moves at a great clip, and then it kind of slows for a moment where we see where he is at his life right now. And this older guy in a big ass mansion, you know, with not much furniture and just boatloads of cereal, you know, of him on the Wheaties box. So, you know, and then just his urgency to try to reinvent himself and, you know, go see the agent. And then once he makes that moment of leaving the agency, it's when the shit hits the fan, and then we're off to the races. So
The Underdogs is fantastic. I encourage everyone to go check it out on Amazon Prime, available this Friday, January 26th. While I have you, Charles, we'd love to dive into some of the rest of your career. Of course, the very famous Was Up commercials, which are still hysterical, still trend-setting. I don't know if you still shoot commercials, but how do you manage expectations? I'm sure the thought process is, whomever's hiring you, we're going to make this thing go viral. How do you manage that between the craft of just making something memorable but also popular?
Well, you know what? That's a great question for my ego as well as for my heart, or and anyone in this position, that kind of a question, because for me, it's for the ego. It's like the ego would say, it's fucking great. It's awesome. You know what I mean? It's all about, like, you know, that achieving that level of adulation and praise and awards and attention and exposure. But what I have to do as a filmmaker is put the ego to the side and just focus on trusting the intent of what it is I'm doing, right? The story, what is at the heart of the story? What is at the heart of the What's Up, you know, the short film that I did that became the campaign? Because four guys screaming "What's up" into a phone, you know, that could be borderline, you know, minstrel, you know, and so I have to be careful about that. So it's like, what is it about those four guys that makes them screaming into the phone funny or even profound? And that's just guys. And it's not just guys, women do this too. Friends do this, where I call it holding hands through the phone, where you're just like on the phone, you're not really talking to the person, you're both watching television almost like together. So people really click with that. And then the "What's up" part just is the icing on the cake. So in terms of this Underdog, same thing. It's like, what is understanding what it is I'm making and staying focused on that, and just trust that the rest will follow, you know, that that it will get the exposure it needs to, it deserves, it will get the awards that it deserves. In anything that we all do as artists, as whatever we do, it's about focusing in on the process. Because don't get me wrong, I dream about my Oscar speech all the time, but I have to only devote a small amount of time to that and really devote the energy towards whatever it is that I'm creating. And if it gets the Oscar, great. If it kills in the box office, great. Yeah, we want that. And it's good business for me, because then it lets the studios know, okay, Charles is a viable asset. He gets butts in the seats. Let's give him more money to do more projects. So if it bombs, that could be detrimental to me paying the rent, so to speak. But again, I just gotta focus on whatever the project is and the heart of that, and trust that everything else will hopefully follow.
The best comp I can pay you about Mr. 3000 is, my sister-in-law cried at the end of it. So she was particularly moved by this story. And as a lifelong baseball fan, of course, I really enjoyed it. Bernie Mac, you know, RIP, We all loved him as an actor. Of course, he was such a special talent. What was he like to work with on that film specifically?
It's so funny when people ask me that. You know, and I think Bernie would laugh too, because he and I had a somewhat contentious relationship when we were shooting. But, you know, through it all, you know, blessings to him, especially is like, you know, we made it happen. Like we came together, and I remember him saying after him seeing it for the first time, like, you know, he says, I think we made a really good movie and I think you did a really great job. And I was like, thank you. You as well. So it was good. And look, regardless of that, like as a professional, I could see the charm. You know, he's just charming and he has this larger than life energy. So I tried to hold on to the intent of what, of who the character is or was and who he is and who he was, and know that that combination was magical. And it was, it was, I think a lot of people were caught off guard because it is a coming of age story about a middle-aged guy, which could sound like, you know, boring, but that's the thing that was important to me, that it'd be more like Bull Durham as opposed to Major League. And the interesting thing is that Jonathan Glickman, who was one of the producers on Underdogs, he was the producer on Mr. 2000. He's the one who called me and said, I got this project I've been working with Snoop on and Kenya Barris, and I want to tell you all about it. And, you know, it's very similar to Mr. 2002 on top of that. But yeah, for sure, it was great. It was great working with him. And I, as a filmmaker, I love the moments that are really important to me are the moments where the epiphany happens, or the realization for the flawed hero, so to speak, where he or she sees what they were doing wrong, or they see the magic of their selflessness when they reach that moment. So when Bernie Mac's character Stan Ross looks at everyone cheering and he's crying and he takes the ball that he, you know, that hit that would put him quote unquote in the history books, he throws it away. That gives me goosebumps. Like in this movie in Underdogs, when 2J's sees the kids grieving, but sees them comfort each other. That's the victory. That's the moment. That's the moment that's the gift that was given to him because he embraced them as family, and that's the win. So those are the moments that, you know what it is? Those are the North Star moments for me as a filmmaker, that I keep my eye on that North Star as I'm going through the craziness that it is to make a movie and the struggles and challenges. As long as I keep my eye on that, then I know I'll be good.
I love the passion. A couple more for it. Let's get out of here. Peyton Folt shot my hometown of Toronto. So clearly you've got experience with musical stars, Cam'ron, Snoop. What was that experience like?
Wow, dude. You know, the Cam'ron thing happened really because the producer, Damon Dash, when we were casting, and he said to me, look, of the three guys, you know, the three main characters, Ace, Mitch and Rico, that one of them had to be from Harlem. Like he said, I just want to make sure that, despite having these really good actors in Makai and Wood, I want someone to like be Harlem. And I was like, I was down with that, but I was like, we got to make sure that, I said, well, bring him in. Like, who do you want me to look at? You know, and he brought in like every MC that he could think of and that he and Jay-Z were working with at the time, Beanie Siegel, a whole bunch of cats showed up, and they were all dope in their own right. But Cam'ron had that thing that I thought, okay, he's the character. I could see that. And in talking to him and stuff, it felt like it could totally work. And he was great. I mean, he basically is the third act. So, yeah. That worked out very well. Again, you know, for me as a director, I love working with cats who, you know, graduated from Juilliard, you know, have like insane theatrical academic backgrounds and training. But I'm also open to cats who have life training, period. You know, as long as that will be my role, is to help them access what I believe for them to already have. What Bernie Mac had, seeing his stand-up, I always knew he's got such great edge, but also such great sort of depth of pathos of like understanding his family upbringing and life, that he'll be able to draw into that. And Snoop, same thing. I mean, Snoop's been a superstar. He knows what it's like to be at the very top. He's probably, he knows what it's like to, for the ego to get out of, get bent out of shape at times. I'm sure he knows, he's aware of all that stuff, and he loves sports. So
yeah,
he will be able to access that. Cam'ron grew up in Harlem. He knew the cats that the movie was originally based on. And he told me, because he was definitely like Joe Pesci. He was a sociopath like Joe Pesci in Goodfellas. But he knew a cat that he grew up with that was that. And he was tailoring his version of Rico from that person. And it was palpable. I mean, it was pretty incredible.
Speaking of incredible, Drumline was the movie, obviously very important within Black culture.
Yeah.
And for Nick Cannon, his breakout. Did you ever expect, Charles, Nick Cannon would be an entity unto himself? And this guy is a workaholic who's built his entire brand. It all begins with Drumline 20 years ago.
Well, first of all, Nick, it was between him, I've got the other cat's name, actor. He was in the final two. And the thing about Nick is that he had this boyish combination of boyishness and sort of edge. And it was super charming, but also felt like he had a sense of edginess to him. So that worked out really well. Again, him too, really open to be directed and wanted to explore the character and very humble in the process. What I discovered in the process, though, is the hardworking thing. Meaning, even as hard as he was working on the role, at the same time, he was constantly in the studio doing music, you know, off hours. Like he was doing comedy shows. And, you know, he at an early age, he developed a real strong work ethic in general. And he used to, I think, tour when he was really young doing stand up. And so now he's like a mogul in his own right, which is great. But I witnessed it while we were shooting. It was like off hours. It was like, where's Nick? He's like, oh, he's in the studio producing so-and-so, or he's putting together this show he's trying to do. And I was just like, oh, so yeah.
It's amazing to think about. What a great career. Charles Stone III. Make sure you check out The Underdogs, available on Amazon Prime this Friday, January 26th. Congrats on a terrific career, Charles. And thanks for all the wonderful stories and for your time, man. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thank you for the questions. I look forward to seeing you on the next one.
Thanks once again to Charles Stone, man. Good dude. Make sure you check out The Underdogs, available on Amazon Prime. Snoop Dogg as an actor. Snoop Lion showing off his skills. Huge football guy. Definitely check it out. I enjoyed watching the movie. I'm glad they sent me the screener, as I mentioned in the interview. Good supporting cast there with Cal Penn, former Cinephile guest and former author, and of course, George Lopez. That does it for Cinephile Oscar nomination special. Lots more content coming down the pike. Thank you, as always, for the support. Thank you to Chris Cody and the Metal Arc team. As always, go to Apple Podcasts, just subscribe, rate, and review, and I'll see you at the movies.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.